We're excited to tell you about Pine Tree Garden Seeds, a women-run, family-owned and operated business since 1979, founded with the simple mission of offering low prices on quality seeds to the home gardener. Over the years, offerings have expanded to include over 1,300 varieties of seeds, including many heirlooms and organics, a huge assortment of tools and gardening gear, and lots of new gardening books.
They also offer roots, plant starts, and tubers, berry bushes, asparagus roots, onion sets, hops, fig trees, sweet potatoes, dahlias, peonies, lilies, and a whole new selection of fall flower bulbs. Located in Maine, they operate out of a 300-year-old farmhouse and strive to offer the best service and products with a personal touch. They continue to hand-pack more than half of their seeds and rely on their Ballard machine from the 1890s to do the rest.
So order your seeds today from superseeds.com and use the promo code GOODDIRT2024 for 20% off your entire order. That's superseeds, SUPERSEEDS.com with our code GOODDIRT2024.
Fast Forward Productions, The Women Are Speaking.
And it was very rewarding because then you realize that nature is trying to be bountiful. It's trying to be abundant. We're basically the ones kind of standing in the way of that happening. So it helps, like, if we work with nature, and then maybe there's some tweaks that need to, it's a little bit of out of balance, but if we work with nature, then it's quite easy to get enough to make a big difference.
You're listening to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is a place where we dig into the nitty-gritty of sustainable living through food, fashion, and lifestyle.
And we're your hosts, Mary and Emma Kingsley, the mother and daughter founder team of Lady Farmer. We're sowing seeds of slow living through our community platform, events, and online marketplace.
We started this podcast as a means to share the wealth of information and quality conversations that we're having in our world as we dream up and deliver ways for each of us to live into the new paradigm, one that is regenerative, balanced, and whole.
We want to put the microphone in front of the voices that need to be heard the most right now. The farmers, the dreamers, the designers, and the doers.
So come cultivate a better world with us. We're so glad you're here. Now, let's dig in.
So just to put everything into context with where we are this morning, we've just spent 15 minutes on Google Drive figuring out Google Docs. How do you feel?
I feel kind of whipped around and just, what an energy leap.
How does that tie into your experience of the Slow Living Challenge? We're in week 3 of the Slow Living Challenge.
Yeah, it's ironic because we talk about it all the time on the podcast. We write about it. We live it to the best of our ability. It's almost like communicating it or just, you know, trying to get our ideas out in the world. It's just like an uphill battle, and just take a deep breath. So we got through it.
Yeah. I just wanted to share a little slice of sometimes what it's like behind the scenes right before we press record, and that we are certainly not slow living experts. We love striving for it, and we love everything. We love talking about it and how important slowing down is. Sure. And just recognizing that all of us have these uphill battles every day, and the way that the technology can both completely enable and inspire and connect us, perfect example is recording this podcast right now. It can also be very frustrating and take our energy, like you said.
Yes. And, you know, we talk about permaculture on this show a lot. And one of the principles of permaculture is the problem is the solution. And that's sort of hard to get your head around, and you think, what? But so often, you know, when something seems a problem and you focus on it and you try to work it out, then it comes around to how the essence of the problem can be used to make things better.
So how does that apply to Google Drive?
Well, obviously, we really depend on Google Drive.
Yeah, we do.
But, you know, what we were just struggling with, it was some crazy setting or something that was given us fits, and you figured it out. And so now I know for next time. So that will be just one more way to use this tool. the Google Drive to help us do what we're doing here.
Well, maybe in the idea of the problem is the solution, maybe we're too dependent on Google Drive, maybe it's just being aware of our dependence on Google Drive. I don't know.
That could be it too. I think, you know, it's just like dream work. We love dream work around here. We think it's a wonderful aspect of slow living and tool. And, you know, in dream work, we say there's no one interpretation of a dream or one meaning of an image or something. It can be so many things. And so this episode is sort of like a dream. We can take several things from it. One being that we learn something from it for the next time. And then what you said, you know, maybe we'd need to wean ourselves from the system we're trying to work with, which is really a good question.
Yeah, it's a good question on so many levels. Wean ourselves from this system we're trying to work with.
Oh, yeah. That was loaded, wasn't it?
That's like every episode of this podcast.
Yes.
Wow.
So here we are approaching the end of our 3-week slow living challenge. What do you have to say about it? What sticks with you from this go round? We've done it every year for quite a few years now, but does anything stand out for you as a particularly meaningful experience this year?
I've loved the daily prompts that we've worked with this year were really easy and accessible. I've had several where choosing to participate really just changed my day or changed my attitude for the day. So that felt great. I think the major takeaway for me is how, I don't know, maybe I need more time with it, but over time, you know, to specifically track over time, but how much of a slow journey. It's a moment to moment stringing moments together thing, in that it's not a cook all your meals from home for a week challenge, or, you know, something that's like a big project and you do it and then you're done and then you have a whole thing to reflect back on. It's just a little more like incremental than that and moment to moment, as opposed to, I don't know, it's a different way of thinking about transformation than I think we're used to thinking. There's not like a before and after. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
So true. And I will once again bring to mind the image of the beaded necklace. And each bead is a moment, and we have the power to transform each of those moments. We don't have the power to control the circumstances in each of those moments, but we do, with consciousness and attention and observation, have some agency in our reaction and our experience of those moments. And you put all of those moments together, eventually they become your hours, days, weeks, and your lifetime. So when you look at it that way, what are you going to do right here with this little bead that's going in the necklace of your lifetime?
It's a lot like meditation. You know, that parallel is drawn a lot between slow living and mindfulness or meditation, where it's like, yeah, if you meditate every day over time, you know, it does it can change your day. And over time, of course, it changes much more, but it's a practice.
Yeah. And meditation is sort of a different thing. But meditation does make it easier to be present in your so-called waking moment. As you are engaging fully in the day, in your life, this ability to slow down, the skill, I'll call it a skill. It's a skill, isn't it?
It is a skill. And it's all about the journey, not the destination, just like nature. Okay. So today's episode, you mentioned permaculture earlier.
Yeah. Today, we're really happy to welcome back Dave and Nikki Schauder to The Good Dirt. We're reconnecting with them and updating our listeners on what's been happening with their business project, Permaculture Gardens. So we talked to them almost 4 years ago now, in June of 2020. This was early in the lockdown, when the buzz about growing your own food was really getting ramped up. Remember the empty shelves and the panic over
food. I remember stocking a lot of like pasta.
Yeah.
So Nikki and Dave started Permaculture Gardens to make permaculture and growing food accessible to everyone, especially families. They specialize in education for backyard vegetable gardens, small space permaculture, and indoor gardening solutions. And as you'll hear, they've gained their knowledge by practicing what they preach. For several years, they grew hundreds of pounds of their own food for themselves and their 6 kids on a small suburban townhouse lot. That's where they started. That's where they learned how to grow hundreds and hundreds of pounds of food for themselves. It's really an incredible story. So during that first interview in 2020, they were doing all of that while the kids were homeschooling. Since that time, we've stayed connected and we have even done some collaborating with them. They've taught workshops for several of our community events, and we've benefited so much from the information and the resources that they've offered over the years.
So now we're really excited to have him back. We want to hear what's new for their family and for Permaculture Gardens, including a move to a place with more space for growing food and children, and an exciting new product for home gardeners to help simplify and streamline the process of growing your own food. And here's a hint. It's an app to help you transform your outdoor space into a thriving, sustainable ecosystem. And you will hear all about it right here in this conversation with Dave and Nikki Schauder of Permaculture Gardens.
Schauder and
I'm Nikki Schauder. We're glad to be back here again at Lady Farmer with you, Mary and Emma. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming back. It's been 4 years. It was right in the middle of COVID 2020 last time we spoke. So yeah.
For anyone who hasn't listened to the first episode, can you explain a little bit about who you are and what you do and how you got to be doing what you're doing?
Yeah, I'd say about 10 years ago, we had had some allergy troubles with our oldest two kids. So our first child was diagnosed as failure to thrive. She was the same weight from about 8 months to 18 months. We thought there were all kinds of medical issues, but in the end, it turned out to be food allergies.
Yeah, that's really hard because when you're already a new parent and it's hard enough to have a newborn who's healthy, but on top of that, to find out there's something wrong and that anything that you're feeding her is not nourishing her, and that even your breast milk was not nourishing her, and they would tell us, don't nurse her. And instead give her these chemicals.
She was allergic to so much. It's like a laundry list of things.
She's allergic to
pork, beef, peas, nuts.
Chicken and eggs, dairy, gluten, nuts, peanuts.
You start wondering, like, what can I feed this child? And here's this chemical powder that smells like powdered corn puffs that you spend like $20 for a little jar of it. And you realize there's something wrong with the whole. So that's already like the first thing that kind of set us on a different path. And then we had the same issue with allergies with our second child. So we started switching to organic food. So that was kind of like the first major course correction in terms of us going from what we were doing before. The second thing I think was I'd always been into gardening, and then we were at a townhouse. So I started growing things in my backyard. I was enthusiastic, but I got no results. Like I planted a bunch of seeds and I got nothing.
We went on a bookstore date when there were still bookstores around, and we found a book on homesteading, and there was this word in it called permaculture. Mm-hmm. And that's where we just went down the rabbit hole of what is this permaculture? And when we found the second aha moment, I would say, was we found this video on greening the desert, and the people who did it used permaculture. And we were just more and more curious, how are they able to green the desert?
It was very inspiring. They had this plateau in China that had been overgrazed and it looked terrible. It was all barren. And then they applied these permaculture principles for 5 years where they had intentional grazing and they planted a bunch of trees. It was kind of like the before and after pictures. It was just complete transformation. So that kind of like triggered us. And then we just went down the rabbit hole. So we started learning of permaculture. And then after we learned it and took some workshops and got certified in that, then we were like, okay, we have to apply this. So the first place was in our kids' elementary school. We did an after-school program with an outdoor classroom.
Yeah, we had 90 kids registered for an after-school program. And we worked with the teachers and we got a grant from Whole Foods, Whole Kids Foundation at that point to just build the raised beds.
And an unused courtyard. They were just large area, maybe 50 feet by 100 feet that they were not using for anything. There's just a sandbox for the elementary kids, for the kindergartners. And we transformed that into a whole garden with raised beds.
With the help of like my permaculture classmates, we had something called a perma blitz. Eagle Scouts came afterwards to build the chalkboard. So now there's an outdoor classroom there and waterproof benches, waterproof chalkboard. I have a great picture of a teacher teaching living versus non-living things outside in the garden. And then lots of stories where you'll hear kids say something like, you were right, Mr. Harbert. You can't see the moon in the middle of the day.
Oh, that's so great. So was the outdoor classroom like in the midst of the garden?
Yes, but the raised garden beds were against the wall. Northern Virginia schools are like this, built with a courtyard garden intended for being a reading garden. And usually that goes unused. But all the raised beds were against the wall. And then in the middle, on the opposite wall, was the big chalkboard and then maybe three rows of benches that are half moon, half circle.
The chalkboard was on a raised platform so the teacher could kind of stand above the kids and mm-hmm. be the center of attention.
And our idea when we designed that was that in between the benches were also berms, plantings. We did have a few like trees that came up and some of them died and some of the bushes. In the end, what they did was the kids did a planting of daffodils. So there were different things that they also planted with their teachers. Other classrooms came in and planted those in between the benches. But the raised beds behind were the ones that were most used.
Oh, wow. That just sounds, and it's still there and still being used. And I want you to tell the audience that hasn't heard your story before about how you started all of this out in a small suburban townhouse with your six children. That's just such a great story about how you found your way to real homegrown food for your children's health. And you pulled this off in a setting that most people would say, can't do it. Not in the cards, but you guys have done it and you have built a business out of it. You have built courses and programs and education, and you've helped so many people find their way to real homegrown food. So tell us about that era of your life, and then you can tell us about your move, your recent move.
Yeah, sure. So of course, we got so excited about permaculture that we wanted to start doing some of that in our townhouse garden, which is like 1/40th of an acre. So we totally turned our backyard into a food forest. And
a shady backyard.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
There was lots of mistakes that we made, but I think it was kind of fixed by the enthusiasm that we put into it. So we put way too many fruit trees in a small space, but there was surprisingly a lot of things that actually worked. Once we got everything kind of established, we were getting like from the small, tiny area, we were getting 300 or 400 pounds of produce a year, which... You know, and it's all great organic berries.
Pawpaws and blackberries for 6 weeks in the summer. And bloomy berries are the first to come up in the spring. Rhubarb, Swiss chard, tomatoes.
Mushrooms,
eggplants, strawberries, echinacea. We're always giving them away, right? Echinacea, even ginger on the deck, banana and ginger on the deck and inside the house.
And it was very rewarding because then you realize that nature is trying to be bountiful. It's trying to be abundant. We're basically the ones kind of standing in the way of that happening. So it helps like if we work with nature, and then maybe there's some tweaks that need to, it's a little bit of out of balance. But if we work with nature, then it's quite easy to get enough to make a big difference in terms of getting your own homegrown.
Yeah. And you think of your little 1/40th of an acre lot, you said. Feeding your family of six, and you compare that with the thousands and thousands and thousands of acres that are thousands of miles away growing food that most people are getting for their family through the grocery store and so forth because they think they can't do it any other way. They think that's the only way to do it. So that's why you guys are such an inspiration.
If you are, you happen to be in a small space, small spaces can be more productive than the Driscoll strawberry farm, acres and acres of strawberries in a field. They're more tended. You notice the bugs. You go out there every time you take your tea out there. And you can grow as much as you want in as much as you can in a small space. And you're surprisingly
a lot.
You taste
the difference in the food, too. It's more nutrient dense. You look forward to eating from your garden, raw food, and it's a lot easier to harvest. There's a lot of time wasted when you go to the supermarket. So it's a lot simpler. You just go out and get your herbs or get your berries.
And it dictates what your meal plan will be when you have that.
You know, I think it's useful to point out here that one of the principles of permaculture, one thing that makes it work in these spaces, is that one of the techniques is high density and diversity. So I remember you saying before, Nikki, that if you look on the seed packet, it'll say put so many inches between plants. And they're speaking to, like, you know, larger areas, several acres, where people are producing like rows and rows of stuff. But this is a different setting, a different context. And a lot of plants thrive being close together and with other things. It helps control bugs and so forth. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, it's funny because I just taught on this and I just got some feedback. I've been asked by Mother Earth News to teach again on this in a few weeks. And they said specifically, you know how those Instagrammers keep on touting, like, you can flout the instructions on the seed packets and grow whatever. I don't know about that. And I was like, yeah, actually, I'm one of those people. So that kind of helped me, like, find that balance too, because I do. One client, she said she had planted too many beans in one plot. But we always teach also from John Jevons' Grow Biointensive book, where he has grow. So I'm going to put that in the show notes for you guys to put in the show notes. How to grow more vegetables than you ever thought possible in the least amount of space. He's very meticulous about the spacing, and they are smaller than the seed packet, but at least it shows you the maximum that you can grow within a raised bed. So let's say, you know, 3 inches between carrots. It depends on the squashes. Yeah, I don't know at the top of my head now, but it kind of helps you see how many. And after a while, that becomes second nature because you know how big it's going to grow. When you start it out, you're not sure. So you kind of have to go by how many inches apart it recommends. But after a while, you get used to it and you can tell, okay, I can put one tomato in a 4x4, a 2x2 square foot.
Yeah, there's some things that are big that are fruiting in the summer, and then they take a lot more space. And then things like carrots can be very dense. You see these things right next to each other and you're like, oh, that's nothing. And then you pull it up. There's this long carrot that comes out. They can grow like right next to each other. It's pretty amazing.
That reminds me, Dave. And the last time we talked, you were doing an experiment with not thinning out the carrots. And that was so timely for me because I just planted a bunch of carrots and I was just thinking to myself, when it comes down to thinning these, I have a really hard time. I just have a hard time thinning things, you know, like, oh no, that's a plant. And I'm just, you know, destroying it. So I kind of struggle with thinning, but I know it's necessary. And then I listened to you say you were experimenting with not thinning carrots. How did that go?
So I think what I've discovered from direct sowing carrots is that once they come in, the way you thin is you just harvest.
You eat it.
You harvest what you need. And that's automatic thinning.
Baby carrots.
The ones that might not be as big, as soon as you've harvested some, there's now a little bit more room, and then they'll fill in.
Of course. Yeah. So you don't have to thin them when they're just the seedlings. You can wait until you have something edible so you don't feel like you're just throwing it away.
Yeah. We found that works a little better. Like a lot of it is the timing, because once carrots hit the summer, and they start getting a bit woody and start flowering and things like that. You can have like a number of weeks, maybe like 2 months, carrots where you're getting a bunch of carrots every couple of days from one patch of, just make a patch of carrots. That's typically how we do it now.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I used to be very meticulous, like with a lot of our other plants, like tomatoes. We start them indoors and then we grow them out to a pretty good size before we transplant them. But we would always do that with carrots, and we get these weird running man roots because the roots of the carrot don't like to be disturbed after they've initially started putting down their whole root system. That's one of the few things that we actually direct sow.
So tell us about how the business and the programs you've developed kind of evolved in your townhouse suburban setting, and then how you've transitioned to another setting.
Well, what inevitably happens when you start growing is you want to grow more and then more and more and more, and then you run out of room. And so at the same time, you know, a townhouse is just for the health and just to have our kids thrive. We knew we needed a bigger space for 6 kids and 4 of them boys, you know, and need to run around. So we were looking during the pandemic also for a location. And it's just super providential to just find where we are right now.
We had all this energy still. So we're doing the outdoor classroom, but then we still wanted to kind of help people.
Because they started asking us, how do you do this?
We couldn't really do it in person because we had a lot of kids and we didn't want to drag them around. So then we started doing online webinars. We would have webinars maybe once a month or once every couple of weeks where we'd present on some of the things that we were learning about permaculture. So we started out with that and kind of built
them. We would still have dates and then we would talk about, well, okay, how would we teach this if it was us learning it for the first time? Because what happens when you learn permaculture, it's very broad. And then you come away with a lot of the theory, but not quite like, how am I going to implement this now? And the big permaculture people were not interested in like a tiny townhouse. You know, how do you help that? No, they want impact. They want broad, large scale agricultural places. So we're like, well, what about all the people who just want to start it like us? So, and how would we have been helped? That's how the course was born, is if we were to do this over and have been taught, how would we like to have done it? So little by little, baby steps, right? First with a microgreen. Some people say start with herbs, but I think the microgreens is your ready win. In a week and 2 weeks, you get something that you've grown. And then
positive feedback, and then you're encouraged. You're like, wow, this was easy.
Yeah. And so that course became the Grow It Yourself program. Became a community membership also. So we consult individually with those in our GIY program, our Grow It Yourself program, once a month. And then for the community, we consult with them like once a month too, but in a group setting. But that's what's nice about the community is you can document your garden. Everybody sees what's going on in your garden too, if you want to share it. And we get to visit. I think one of the highlights too that we've been fortunate enough to do is through our travels, be able to meet up with some of the people who we are serving and seeing the context in which they're growing. So different from ours, you know, drier lands, climates. We just came back from Arizona.
There's somebody in Phoenix.
Visited a Phoenix garden.
Did you go out there to visit them or was this?
No, it's just, okay, we happen to be there or we'll be sent out by, like, Mother Earth Youth sent me around last year. So I was able to meet up with a GIY member in Kansas and in Texas. For me, that's been really inspirational because to see in ground what they're doing and that the permaculture principles of observation and building these intricate relationships in your garden among the plants and the animals, and then seeing how that they apply that in their gardens is just fascinating. Like, wow, it worked here and worked there. And so
it was great. Like, we're in the townhouse and there's a limit to what we could do. And then, but we could live vicariously through all these other people who were setting up their gardens. So really rewarding.
So that's how the business started.
So can you speak a little bit to, is that what you're still currently doing? This might segue into the new app that you've created, but yeah, what's the current update on the community and your work there?
We've been looking for a number of years. And then as these things tend to, you know, happen, there's just the confluence of all the right things. And then we found a property north of Leesburg, Virginia. It's 3 acres. We moved about a year and a half ago. That's just an amazing blessing now, because now if we're feeling down or anything, we just walk outside and it's like, ooh, we feel happy again.
It's like living in the Shire. That's what I think. Don't you think? We would live in a similar place, Mary. It's wonderful that we get to host every 2 months in-person workshops, in-person and live streamed workshops now. So that's another difference. I've also since then taken on some research work. So I have a grant, I have 2 grants on studying compost tea, and it's supported by Southern SARE, which is Sustainable Agricultural Research Education. That's like a little sustainable arm of the USDA. I think that's really being spoiled, like to be able to delve into this world of worms, red wiggler worms, and answering the question, does compost tea really work? Is it worth my time and effort? What exactly happens in the soil? And then teaching kids through camps now. So there's a local vineyard where the vintner is very agriculturally minded and he wants to train the next generation of youth in agriculture. And so he hosts these agricultural camps. And so I have the pleasure of teaching high schoolers how to grow, and I'm going to be teaching them about the soil during the next spring break. So teaching kids, teaching adults, and then Sage, our new app.
Over the years, with all the people that we would help online, we kind of formulated a set of like a process for figuring out how they should design their garden, what things they should grow. and how to be effective with that. And what we discovered is that a lot of people, well, we're presenting all this stuff kind of as paper workbooks and webinars. And a lot of people would be like, well, it would be great if there was some software that would do this as well to help me organize or help me plan all of that information. So in my day job, I'm a software engineer. Of course, the wheels were turning in my head. I'm thinking to myself, yes, it would be nice if there was some software that did this. So a couple of years ago, I started putting that together. I wanted to create a holistic garden management software that would combine the journaling and the observations, the designing, and kind of figuring out where the spaces and the things should go in your garden. And then also the actual like practical, okay, what's my to-dos? What should I start my seeds? What's my planting calendar? And kind of combine that into something where it's just a single app that does all of that. So the information is the same. Your plants are the same. It's just you're looking at it in a different perspective. You're looking at it. Sometimes you're looking at what's it going to look like aesthetically? How are is the layout of these things going to work? Sometimes you're thinking about like, oh, when do I start the seeds for my tomatoes or my cucumber? The big thing that we eventually like to do is if enough people start using the software, that we develop an online community. So there's this development of online knowledge where people learn from each other and they have peer design sessions with each other and they can see somebody else's designs that worked and figure out which part of that they can apply in their own garden.
That sounds fantastic. So right now it's like a database thing, but it would sort of evolve into a crowdsource resource for information.
Yes, a crowdsource database. That was always the dream. Because he had like another venture, which was scuba diving.
This is before kids.
And it was so popular because it was crowdsourced. Like they would list where the best diving places were. And it was just fed by all the people who
all used the scuba divers.
All the scuba divers. And so we know that that's the way to go. It's not going to be done by one person that has the database. Initially it is, but then the key to making it really helpful to people is that other people and their own real life experiences can feed that database.
Because we felt like there's a lot of agricultural knowledge out there but it's very hard to access it. Forums or you search on cooperative extension offices. It's very difficult to actually get all this information in one place and see how it relates to each other. That was kind of like a second goal for us, is just really to kind of develop that as an online knowledge store for everybody, for the kind of like for the 21st century type of thing.
It reminds me a little bit of like, I'm thinking of Waze. Waze is like a directional app, you know, where the traffic is and the road problems and stuff. But is it a similar thing where people could like describe it? Like, what does it look like?
For this first version that we're kind of preparing.
For our Kickstarter on May 17th.
Oh, Kickstarter. Oh, yeah. Okay.
To kind of open up to the public.
March 18th.
There's kind of four parts of that. Currently, it's like a 2D overhead designer. So where you can draw things spatially. So you can put your fruit trees and your raised beds and figure out the things that are in the raised beds and kind of see that in a spatial view of, you know, how the rotations would go and things like that, and this, how the space would be used up. There's another part where you're kind of seeing all the plant information, where all the harvests, all the information about spacing and number of plants and expected harvest. That's kind of like the power user portion of it, where you can get dates.
Open the app, and then it asks you where you live because it's going to access your specific data and climate data. And then it also asks you, what's the space that you're working?
Your climactic zone.
So does it ask you the space? And then afterwards, it asks you, do you want to plant mostly perennials or mostly annuals? And then that's where it kind of, so it walks you through a wizard. And if you say like mostly annuals, like a raised bed, then it will ask you to put in the crops and it'll spit out the dates that you need to do stuff with the crops in. But not only that, it'll plug it into your calendar and give you notifications and email and your phone as to when you need to seed start, transplant, harvest them. That's your raised bed. But if you wanted to mix it in with your perennials, like if you wanted to create something like a guild, then it walks you through that process too, where it asks you to go through, well, what exactly would you consider like your star player? What in this guild of collection of plants do you really want to get a harvest from?
You right? should maybe explain what a guild is.
Oh, yeah. So a permaculture guild is a collection of, think of it as players in an orchestra all creating a nice symphony. But we like to think of it as, and probably no other permaculture person talks about it this way, is there's a star player. Because otherwise, it's so hard to, how does a guild go? It's just too fluid. And I'm sure you can do it without a star player, but this is how we our approach to it. What is your star player? So let's say it's an apple tree. That's your star player. And then you start thinking of all the supporting species that would support the growth of that apple tree. And you first think of it in terms of function.
Yeah. So you think like, well, you're going to need something to pollinate the apple tree or suppress the weeds underneath the apple tree or feed the apple tree the nutrients and minerals that it requires. So when you look in nature, you see that things do not live in isolation. Nature is actually the perfect example. When you look at an ecosystem, most of the things are actually working together. They're supporting each other. So they fill their little niche, their little role that they play in that ecosystem. And they're very good at that. And then they all work together. And that's how you get this beautiful.
And that happens above ground and it happens below ground in the root zone as well. Yeah. So from there, there's prompts to ask you, well, what would you do for nitrogen? Pick among these two. And what would you do for pollination? Pick among these possibilities, these flowers, let's say. And so little by little kind of helps you build that guild without the overwhelm of like having to know, oh,
the hundreds of
plants that you could possibly make as a combination, just at least as a starting point. And then from there, it helps you see also the diversity. If you only plant plants that are the members of the same family, for instance, in a raised bed, like brassica members will attract a lot of bugs. So it kind of will show you, oh, you don't have any legumes or you don't have any alliums. Legumes provide nitrogen. Alliums are great pest deterrents. So it will show you like different top, we have a 7 to 9 top families that most people, gardeners, vegetable gardeners kind of choose. And it kind of helps you, you don't have to fill all the 7 to 9, but kind of helps you see, oh no, I only chose members of the mint family and I forgot about the rest. Or it kind of helps you think about swapping out some of those for more diverse choices. So that's, I think, one of the things that I like about Sage is that those prompts, whereas if you're just given a blank slate and told make a guild and don't have any reference, that's one of the things I like about Sage. Yeah.
So is this accessed on your phone?
Not currently. We're developing as a kind of a web application. You log in on a browser because I think we'll see how much people like some portions of it make sense on a phone, but some of the things like the design probably won't make sense on a
phone. Hard to design on a phone.
So if you're drawing large maps and things like you want to take photos of your plants, like what bug is this? That makes sense. So probably a little later in the year, we'll kind of take stock and figure out whether we should do an app that goes along with the web app.
And do you have to be a part of the community to use the web app, or how do the community and the web app work together?
Right now they're separate. So the community is outside of the web app, but that's later on we would move the community and make it all in.
Yeah,
in
so I, what I really wanted to do when I talked about building that community online within Sage is to have the ability for, so you have your own garden that you're managing, designing and planning and organizing, but having the ability to then decide which parts of that you can share with other people. There'll be later on in the year a community space where you can see all the designs and favorite plants that people are growing and guilds and things like that that the members have decided to share with the community. And then we'll organize activities online, like everybody will help to design somebody's garden or something like that. So we're going to have these regular community activities, kind of leveraging the software to kind of encourage the development of that community. Because we feel that's a big, important part of permaculture is the human connection part of it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And just having people to ask these particular questions, especially in this kind of less than conventional way of doing things. Because to your point a few minutes ago, Dave, if you just Google it online, you're going to get the, you know, sort of advice from your, what do they call it? Your local
extension agent?
Yeah. You're going to get the advice from the local extension agent that's going to be pretty broad and kind of generic. And it's just, it's not very satisfying to those of us that are like, you know, really trying to tweak it a little bit and go a little deeper in, into this more sustainable, earth-friendly approach. And I think our community will really appreciate from the get-go just knowing when to plant something for their specific location. That's really hard to pinpoint. And this, your app does that, correct?
Yeah, so it takes your local weather station, all the data from that, just to give recommendations in terms of planting windows. So that's like a good first step to get everybody like, I'm not overwhelmed about when I should start all this stuff. But then also, we really encourage the observing part. If everybody kind of tracks when the things actually grew in there,
they could change that date for themselves. Or if they saw, well, that wasn't right, you know, the next year, they could say, I should be 2 weeks earlier because of climate change or, you know, whatever they're experiencing. The other thing also I want to mention was, it is like the reason that it's called Sage, one of the reasons, is because we don't have the mentors that we would have had maybe 100 years ago with that experience of growing to pass that on to the next generation. And that's what we hope this will bring, like collectively our knowledge of what we're experiencing. We could use technology to make that information available more quickly to those of us who are just starting to garden now.
Yes, sage means wisdom, and it's also an herb.
Here are some things we love about Pine Tree Garden Seeds. For one thing, they're lady farmers. It's a woman-owned and woman-run company. 85% of their staff is female.
And they've recently switched to a more sustainable envelope to ship seeds. Their new mailers are completely recyclable, made of paper and a cushioning material that is specifically designed to easily separate from the paper fibers during the repulping and recycling process.
They're also longtime members and supporters of the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association and signers of the Safe Seed Pledge, promising to never knowingly sell any GMO seeds. They do germination testing throughout the year on every single seed variety they carry, so they can stand behind their viability guarantee.
Pine Tree Garden Seeds is meant for every level of expertise, for the yard artists, the backyard growers, the herb explorers, the bouquet builders, the habitat curators, and beyond. They're committed to helping you get the most out of your home garden by providing high-quality garden seeds, plants, and supplies at an affordable price. Get your spring garden going today by ordering your seeds from superseeds.com and using our promo code GOODDIRT2024 for 20% off your entire order. That's SUPERSEEDS.com with our code GOODDIRT2024.
So the last time we talked, you spoke about this observation piece. And you said how one of your mentors taught you that you can do this. You can grow your own food in literally 15 minutes a day. And 7 minutes of that is observation. So do you still stand by that 4 years later?
And even more now. Amy Strauss is the person. I just want to credit her because that's really her words. And she's an amazing teacher. If you ever want to interview her as well, she's great. And she says 7 minutes out of the 15 should be spent observing it. Recently, we had a permaculture design boot camp. And we were going deeper into these permaculture designers and what was their secret. And basically, the secret is really stopping to observe. If there's a takeaway, I know one of the questions was like, what do you want your audience to take away about permaculture? First is observation, in the sense that when you design, culture is all about design, you're looking at, this is from Dan Palmer, a permaculturalist who has since passed. You're looking at, where are the tensions in this room, even when you're designing architecturally, because he takes this from another designer named, architect named Christopher Alexander's. Where are the tensions here? Look at the landscape, and the water is rushing through all the time here, washing away that soil. Where can I make that not happen? Or even like, it's tense here because it's soggy. It's tense here because it's always windy. Then you start thinking, well, what windbreaks can I plant? This was an architectural example. Like, even if you stand here where we are right now is a window, and at certain points in the winter, actually, it gets too hot in this window. And that is a tension that you don't even realize until you start observing and then start thinking, well, then that needs shade, or what can I do for that?
Yeah, I think that one of the things with permaculture, they also call it lazy gardening. So there's this gradual evolution. It's not instant, but over time, you work in more perennial food systems into your garden. They're in tune with the seasons, and they're just generally easier to take care of because you're not starting seeds every year. The things come back every year. They have a more established root system. And then that takes a lot of the burden in terms of food production, because you know that the certain berry or whatever will emerge, and at the kind of around the same time of the year, it's going to produce something. So that it makes that idea that you can harvest a lot of your food from your garden a lot easier. You know, you get your herbs established and your berries and your fruit trees and things like that.
Yeah, perennials for sure. I have a few projects that we're doing around the house. Dave has more than me, but one of them recently has been last weekend. I was in West Virginia getting willow cuttings from a permaculture friend. And my idea is, because we don't have any fencing, and fencing is expensive. We have so many deer, and fencing also to protect from the chickens. And also we are right by the road, is to create a willow fence. Now, willow is one of those amazing plants here that just grows pretty much like a weed in soggy places. You can form a fence by just putting it in the ground in like these X ways. And it's very beautiful, like weaving a living basket on your property.
The wattle fence, isn't it called the wattle fence?
Well, there's a different one. The wattle fence is sticks straight up, like
it's
how the Indians.
Willow, but
it's still willow, but yeah. But what I'm doing is something like where it's crossing. You know, there's so many. It's so such a versatile plant. And it's a little bit, so I don't know how much the maintenance will be, but I'll have to be cutting willow to keep that fence from just growing over. Because where I took it from, the people who were not interested in that willow temple that was created. And I could just get as many, it took 100 cuttings to make this willow privacy fence and pretty fence. And from there, I get material for future fences that even that are not living, that I want to make wattle fence or keep away from the chickens, that are beautiful, that are not plasticky, and basket, and so many things. So it's just such a joy to keep on working in this kind of setting and just going deeper in all the aspects of nature in permaculture. So that's one thing, like the harvest, the yield, and relationships, like we mentioned earlier, the relationships of the pollinators, the plants, the animals that you support in what you plant, and then the relationships below ground that you're also supporting, and the relationships with the people that we're talking to. So even the way that our business is run, we try to do it in this permaculture way where we are relying on the relationships like yours and giving back to each other in these ways to make both our communities stronger.
Kind of related to that, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how your kids are involved. Do they help at all with the gardening and such, or are they over it?
I think the younger kids are definitely a little bit more enthusiastic because
they grew up with it.
One of the things that we do just to kind of motivate them is we have a harvest competition.
Oh, you're still doing that. You mentioned that the first time. Oh, great. Yeah, tell us about that again.
Each of the kids have a choice of a kind of a plant category that they can pick. So it could be mushrooms, it could be fruit or brassicas or tomatoes or something. So they pick one thing and then they're in charge of that. So that means they should plan what kind of seeds they should start. They should take care of those plants in the garden. And then they have to weigh all the harvests. They log all their harvests that they get for that specific plant category. And at the end of the year, whoever wins gets we call them like Captain Mushroom or Captain Tomato. Whoever wins gets a promotion. So they become major or they become colonel. Like a really fun family outing. For the whole family.
They picked laser tag. So we were giving them like, do you want to see the illusionists at the Kennedy Center?
Did you play laser tag? Did you get
out? Oh, yeah.
I want to know what you're growing in your new place. And you have, is it a farm? Is it a farmette? Is it a big yard? What is it?
So it's kind of on a gradual slope. 3 acres, half of it is already cleared, but there's a lot of deer. So what happened was the first year, I tried planting some things outside. I was kind of observing, like, what will the deer eat? Well, they eat everything. There was a little area that was fenced off, and we put some raised beds in there. And they did really well. Like in terms of brassicas, for example, there's this, we right overplanted now. Collard greens and we had over 100 pounds of.
We have tree collards. Yeah, we have a lot of kale right now.
So those raised beds, we kind of set up our regular raised bed system and improved the soil. So the annual production was very good. We normally do like 3-season rotation growing. So we'll plant some spring stuff and then we'll put in summer stuff around June. Right now we're growing like peas and there's some things that overwintered like spinach. We have some spring onions that have overwintered. But what we're gradually moving to this year is putting in more of those perennials.
And flowers.
So a lot of your supporting flowers are things like calendula and nasturtium and yarrow. And there's a lot of ornamental flowers too, like zinnias and dahlias and things like that. But also like we're now trying to put in our berries. So we put in gumi berries, which we found to be just an amazing companion plant for your fruit trees because they fix nitrogen. It's like a candy store that's growing next to your fruit tree. I've got a number of other fruit trees that I put in. We have like gooseberries and blackberries and raspberries. We already had strawberries that we put in last year. I'm growing rhubarb that's come back. And then we're going to have little areas. So instead of just raised beds, there's going to be more like in-ground beds that are easier to set up. So they'll have more natural curves. So we're going to have things like asparagus bed, but or like grains bed. So we'll have some sorghum and some...
And a place to put your flax.
Wonderful, wonderful. With the perennials, do you concentrate on natives? How do you approach that issue?
So I'm not too much of a stickler for natives, except for like, I want to support the pollinators. Of course, I gotta plant the natives. But the non-native things... we don't necessarily like we have Japanese maple, we have Tree of Heaven that they're supporting, the spotted lanternfly, you know, those kind of relationships you don't want to encourage. And I do like, if I have, I don't go out of my way yet. What is a not native thing that we're growing that we like? Bananas and citrus and things like that. They're still edible and they're in pots. But for the ground things, we try to do natives to support the native populations of insects.
I think a big reason to grow native fruit trees or nut trees is because they grow well.
They belong here. Yeah.
So there's things that have historically not, that used to grow well, that don't grow well, that we'd love to establish. Like they now have hybrid chestnuts that are immune to some of the diseases that killed the original American chestnuts.
Or chinkapins, which are related to chestnuts. Those are native. Oh, Virginia forest or pawpaws.
Pawpaws is a good example of things that people don't know that much about anymore.
If you have to choose, then you kind of do a little cursory research and see, well, what is the native variety of the thing that I want to grow? You know, and can I get that?
But I think we're also looking at not just like, well, it's native, but it has no function. Like we're not getting anything out of it.
Most of them do have at least supporting functions if they're native. So it's default that yes, we do plant a lot of natives, but not because we like intentionally want to do the all native garden.
And sometimes, you know, if you already have non-native things that are doing okay and they're not invasive and they're not like breeding lantern flies or whatever, then yeah, like you guys, I discovered gumi berries several years ago. They look like autumn olive, except they're bigger.
But we find they taste much better and then they're...
Oh. Easier to harvest.
Yes.
To your point, Dave, you said a minute ago, it's like having a candy tree. It is. When that thing is in full fruit, it's magical. I love taking people out there and say, help yourself. We can't possibly eat them all. It's just like, it's like Christmas Day. What a great tree. But yeah, I think it is a cousin of the autumn olive, which everybody loves to hate. But this is different. It's bigger. It's way bigger. The fruit is.
It doesn't spread, we found.
It doesn't spread, yeah.
We love that. The nice thing, too, is the birds will, they'll eat it, but there's more than enough to go around.
Oh, there's so many.
And they prefer that. Like we, in our old townhouse, we'd have a large blackberry, upright blackberry along the fence, and there would be tons of blackberries, but the birds would go after the gumi berries and totally ignore the blackberries. Now I don't know if that's going to happen. That might have just been where we were, but I thought that was really a neat kind of like side benefit, is that I don't mind sharing the gummy berries.
Right. Yeah, don't take my blackberries. Well, I did visit when you all were still in the townhouse and you had that workshop one day. So I got to see how the gummy berry tree was kind of the centerpiece of that food forest. And it was fruiting then. And I can see how visually the birds would go there first. Blackberries were not as impressive right next to it. But they don't bloom at this. They don't fruit at the same time, do they?
The blackberries come a little later.
Yeah. Anyway, it was amazing what you all did in that little space. And I look forward to coming to one of your in-person workshops where you are now, because it's not too far at all, and seeing what you're doing out there. One more thing I wanted to ask you before we kind of start winding it up is, have you noticed over the 10 years you've been doing this, have you been influenced or affected by any of the warming trend that we're seeing? I'm certainly seeing it in my place here. And I've been here 10 years. Just wondering if y'all are actually noticing it.
We have a friend who actually specializes in looking at the tropical fruits that could grow as the climate is changing and seeing how far they could push, like, the growth of, what does he do?
Oh, there's all kinds of things. There's like moringa.
Chris Smith, yeah, moringa.
And kind of like there's legumes that do well in the heat and the humidity mm-hmm. of the South. So he's kind of...
He's in North Carolina, in Asheville. And so he will sometimes, we're part of his Patreon, he'll sometimes send us a certain taro root that, for instance, I would grow in the Philippines and see how far we could grow that here. And some of this, like, I'm trying with this calamondin tree, bringing it in, bringing it out. So you're trying to see, like, how far, how much with that changing climate, how can you still maximize your harvest?
And, well, you don't want to be stressed.
Like, you don't want to be stressed.
That's
yeah.
That's the big thing. Like when we go to Phoenix and then you see people trying to grow apple trees, they're Arizona. Growing in Arizona. Yeah. The climate could be a really big source of stress. But by kind of adapting and thinking, okay, what things are now going to grow the best in this kind of warming mm-hmm. trend? It kind of relieves a little bit of the stress. At least you're saying, okay, I can still be quite successful. I might just have to grow things slightly differently than I did before.
Yeah, I think it also, there's more hope to like warming than it is to cooling, because we just watched like this movie on snow and the society of the snow and how you cannot live off of anything. My kids were watching it and you cannot live off anything in the snowy weather. But if you were in the desert, you can live off the saguaro cactus, which is an emblem of the Sonoran deserts, right? And so there are these things, but being creative about how you cultivate that and how you protect it and how you shade it and how you can still green and sop up all the water, especially like half of the United States is desert arid climate. We are lucky here in the east, right? And the west is more arid. And that, seeing that and seeing how you have to try a little bit harder to capture all the water into the landscape.
I think for me, that's the biggest takeaway. Like, the climate can change, but as long as there's life, like if you're not eliminating the life, there's many cases, people don't realize this, but that life has actually changed the climate. It can control the climate. If you have a big forest, it will actually affect the local climate. There's certain bacteria that live on the leaves of the trees that will increase the precipitation in the clouds. But the important thing is having that life. Once you're like anti-life, then you can't fix anything. But life can help deal with it. You know, we're messing up the world in many ways. But if we work with nature, we can also heal the world.
And that includes the life in the soil.
Yeah. And that's why, like, bringing that precipitation and bringing that water in to the ground is really key, especially in the desert climate, is you're always trying to keep that moist to cultivate the life there. That's what my new best friends are, my red wriggler worms.
And this is why your work with the composting, Nikki, is so, so, so relevant, you know, to our discussion and just the good dirt. You know, we're telling people all the time that anybody, no matter your living situation or your setting or whatever, everybody can facilitate good dirt. Even if you're just composting some of your food.
So with everything that you have going on and you're building an app and the six kids and all of everything that you're doing, how do you experience slow living and what does slow living mean to you?
We were just talking about that this morning. This is the number one question for us. One is, this morning we had chiropractor day. We're fortunate enough. It's a really good coverage that we can do this. And Dave does it every week and I do it every other week. That helps slow us down. And the garden.
I think the biggest thing is we have a nice patio that's sitting right next to the garden. And then we have benches that are in the garden. We're doing all this stuff. So it's definitely not as slow as we'd like to be. But we take these moments where we kind of like, okay, I'm going too fast. I need to take a step back. So that just helps when you just kind of take it, especially the spring now on a day like today. I was just mentioning to Nikki, like everything's been sleeping the whole winter. And then you go out and you start noticing the plants starting to wake up, the bees coming out and the buds forming. And the sensorial overload, there's the smells. And you just take that all in and it really helps to kind of slow you down.
Yeah. And prayer out in the garden, meditation. And right after this one, I have one of my business buddies, actually, she got me into this, but we're taking some time to just hop on a call and actually pray together. So
that's lovely.
I, in the middle of the day, and we both need it. We're super both busy. She has 5 kids and we're both trying to run our businesses, but those are important. So I got to prioritize that.
I love it. And what does the good dirt mean to you?
For me, the good dirt means life in the soil that supports the life above the soil. As I mentioned, I think my work with compost tea is just unraveling so much more than I thought it would in the beginning. If you Google, is compost tea good? You're going to get no right now. But, you know, I can do it in a scientific way. So I send out the compost and the compost tea to labs. I send out the produce that comes from compost tea versus non, and they can measure the nutrient density in polyphenols right now of those.
You're doing all this already?
Yeah, it's really exciting. And they can measure what the bacteria, they sort of like flash freeze my little sample and run a DNA test on it and can say what kind of bacteria are in my living compost versus my compost tea to just see what the difference is, like what is amplified or what dies, and then what do those bacteria actually do for the plants?
It's super cool because it's like layers of, you go deeper and then there's another.
These are just the bacteria because they can't do DNA sequencing for fungi yet. So just exploring that, like all these different bacteria do different things with the plants and they're overlapping like above ground, right? We're trying to create these intricate relationships, symbiotic relationships that overlap. For instance, yarrow, it's a medicinal, but it's also a pollinator. It's also a ground cover. These redundancies make your system more stable so that if one crop fails, you still have another crop that kind of answers it. It's the same thing in a microscopic level to see when we till or rototill. You know, whenever we pull a carrot, you kind of disrupt the earth a little bit. But it's not that bad, right? If you just kind of wiggle the dirt and try to get some air in it. But when you rototill or plow it or overgraze it, a soil over and over every season, that same spot, you see that black chocolate cake dirt that's moist becomes this dust,
gray
brown dust, blows away in the wind. That comes to mind right now is hiking the Grand Canyon. Everything's just blowing away. And so that kind of dirt is not good because there is no life in it. And that is quickly transformed because when you rototill, you break the fungal networks, you break those relationships that have been established. And that's why Dave is a proponent and permaculture is a proponent of perennials, is because you create those stable elders in your system that are like big trees or big root systems that people can rely, people, microbes can rely on year after year, season after season. And so when we cut down trees or deforest, it's huge impact. You know, it's killing off all the elders, killing off all the stability in that soil. So that is the good dirt to me.
Wow. I'm so impressed with your studies there. I can't wait to hear more about that.
Well, I'll just have to come back.
Also, can you remind us, you mentioned it earlier, but chat us a bit through the Kickstarter and when it's going and how people can find that and then you specifically. Yeah.
So this Kickstarter is starting officially March 18. You can become a Sage VIP where we give you a Kickstarter tier that is unique only to you. If you go to permaculturegardens.org/sage, you will see a video explaining what we do right now and what this app is going to do for you. And then you can come on the wait list or become a Sage VIP. And then we will be kickstarting from March 18th to April 18th.
Yeah, the purpose of the Kickstarter is kind of like to really generate the interest. You know, I'm doing a lot of the software development, but to really generate that kind of interest in the community so that we can kind of work together to build that ideal garden app.
Because it has been the community that's fed this creation of the app, and we've gotten a lot of feedback like we would love to see this and that. And so the main feature requests that are coming out in this first version of the app have been because of the community members who beta tested it, tried it out, and given us their feedback. It's built by you, built by people who want something to simplify garden planning.
Yes. Oh, thank you. So it starts March 18th. It goes through April 18th.
That is correct.
We'll link in the show notes so people can go straight there and sign up, and we'll follow. And tell us the other things you have going on that our listeners can get involved in and how to find you.
Oh, thank you. So we also have the Grow It Yourself program, which is a 12-month. We guide you step by step to realizing the garden of your dreams.
We also have lots of plant materials.
That we send our Grow It Yourself members.
Seeds and cuttings and ginger, you know, different perennials.
Yeah. We send you a permakit. It's a lot of fun to be in that membership. And it's part of it is the core course where we teach you how to grow your own food in little snippets, little videos, step by step.
We also have the workshops that are, the next one will be coming up
May 4th. Yes.
So that'll be kind of like, get your summer going.
We have seed starting workshops online. If you get on our newsletter at permaculturegardens.org, you'll learn more about us. We have lots of blogs there for free as well. We have so many things coming up, so I'm not going to mention it. But those are the few that we would love for you to see, you know, help see how we can help you grow abundantly as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It was so fun catching up with you all and hearing your updates from 4 years ago now. We invite our listeners to go back and listen to the episode from June 2020. That was during COVID. Wow. So you were homeschooling your kids. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot going on then too. So thank you so much for being here.
Tuning in, calling in, and spreading the good dirt. We love hearing from you. You can reach our listener voicemail at 443-459-1950. That's 443-459-1950. You can find this number in our show notes and in our Instagram profile.
This show is produced by Lady Farmer, a slow living lifestyle community, and the original music is composed and performed by John Kingsley.
For more from Lady Farmer, follow us on Instagram at @WeAreLadyFarmer. That's @WeAreLadyFarmer. Or join us online at www.ladyfarmer.com. We'll see you next time on The Good Dirt.
Goodbye.